All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome again to our ICAT Task Force meeting. Let's see, I know we have a couple of members who are absent today, but of those that are here, we have Cheryl Turney, Alex Goss, Andy Truscott, Anil Jain, Deb Strickland, Denise Webb, Gus Gerarcy, Jim Georges, Mary Green, Ron Shuram, and Steve Brown. Are there any others that I may have missed on the phone or Adobe?
Hi, Lauren. It's Alexis Snyder.
Hi, Alexis. Anyone else? Great. I am turning it over to our co-chair. You're going to start it.
Why, thank you. This is Alex Goss, and I'm going to go ahead and get us started today. Hopefully you can all hear me. We are going to launch our meeting with the usual summary and action plan review, followed by a deep dive into contributions to our draft paper and the comments that have been submitted. Do a shout out to Alexis for working in the document. We've done, Cheryl and I have done some review with the team on the comments received. And so Cheryl's going to be walking us through the draft document and some other related artifacts with the support of Michael Witte, who is our lead staff from ONC and currently dubbed our editor extraordinaire. We're also going to tackle a few of the plans moving forward and provide time for public comment. With that said, if we could go to the next slide, please. And one more, thank you. So our last meeting was a really another productive session, building on our review of the work of the synthesizing teams. We had last week a deep dive into the recommendations work that had been prepared so far. Thanks to Rich Landon walking us through the process that he and Arian Malik took to synthesize the documentation from earlier work on recommendations. We walked through their body of recommendations and garnered some further clarity and got some feedback that will help Rich and Arian, who I do not believe are available today, but for them to finish up that work. It also provides us with a lot of opportunity to refresh ourselves on the work from the last few months, now that we've had a review of the guiding principles, ideal state, and now recommendations work. We also started to talk more about the approach to the draft report and how we would be engaging in a master draft working document. We're going to continue some of the discussion of that draft report structure today. So without further ado, I want to do a shout out to acknowledge that Arian has joined us and to go to the next slide, which I believe we're going to be actually pivoting to an approach where I think, Cheryl, you're going to be walking us through content today, and Michael will be sharing his screen, and I'm going to support the two of you through managing Q&A.
That's correct. Thank you, Alex.
You're welcome. Take it away.
We're going to start by looking at the document that Deb and I worked on related to gaps in the recommendations, ideal state, and guiding principles. So Michael's going to share that, and he's actually going to be flipping through that between that document and the recommendations that we reviewed last week. And so that you guys can see it and we can have some discussions on the fly. Right now, Michael, we're seeing like a blue screen.
Yep, I'm getting there. Apparently I shared and then unshared somehow.
Okay. We can wait.
There you go. That, you see okay. The gap?
It came on and then it went away. I've had some issues with my computer today.
It's not you, Cheryl. It was there for a brief moment and then went away. So I believe he stopped sharing, and it looks like he may be resharing in one of the allocated pods at the moment.
What I am doing.
Okay.
There we are. You see that?
I'm just glad I have access to my computer again. I was like, oh, no, I have so many things going on today. Okay. So here's the recommendations that were made, and there were some comments that we will walk through to the recommendations, but the first thing we're going to look at is the GAAP document. Now, Michael, you'll have to bear with me because I can't read that, so I actually have it up on my screen so I can actually read the version. But on the first GAAP, I'll read it. It basically was the priority target area of patient access to personal health information. And we had indicated that the GAAP that had been called out was the ability to check on the status of a prior authorization electronically by the patient does not currently exist today. In today's world, the patient has to call both the provider and the payer to check on the status and find out why it is stuck. So the second bullet was patients don't know who to contact if they have issues with a prior authorization. You know, when they call the payer, they're basically only given a customer service number, and often they don't even know the prior authorization is in process. So they never can really get an updated status on what's going on. And recommendation 7 in the ICAD recommendations does actually speak to a patient-centered workflow, but it doesn't specifically call out, you know, what we're talking about relative to that. So if you bring up the recommendations, Michael, maybe it's easier if you keep the recommendations up, and I'll just talk about the gaps that were brought up. But
so, Cheryl, I would agree with you that if you could talk through, because I think that the what he was showing was a track changes document. It may be easier for you to just walk him through there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what I'll do. All right, so you might need to make it a little bit bigger for them to read it, Michael, because it's a little hard to read. But
does that
help? The draft, okay, is that better? I can read it now. We want to go to recommendation 7.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in 7, it's develop patient-centered workflow and standards. And here we talk about, you know, a workhorse administrative standards in the second paragraph, like eligibility, claiming, and electronic EOB remittance that are traditionally considered provider to payer should allow access through the same API frameworks already supporting API access, convergence of clinical administrative workflows, including prior authorization, should be designed to support API access and patient engagement as a matter of course. I don't know if that was detailed enough to, you know, provide the vision that we were looking at. And also here, we talk about the current EOB API, but really the EOB API is the patient access API. So I'm thinking we need to standardize the wording so that we're consistent across our document on what API we would be talking about. Because today, what's in the EOB is what would be the patient access.
So just to be clear in this section, so I agree, I definitely agree with the intent. And if the wording isn't making it clear, then we need to change the wording. But just in the context of this sentence, the intent is to say that the status, so first of all, the intent here is to say that all administrative standards are designed for patient access and involvement. That's inclusive of even workhorse administrative standards like eligibility claiming and EOB, and that not only as is currently available in the Smart on Fire APIs for payer blue button that are EOB at the end of the process, that this should be available throughout the process, so throughout the claiming process. But again, completely, the intent is super clear, so totally harmonized on the intent, and if we need to change the wording to make the intent clear, totally good on that.
I just wanted to make sure that, you know, because that was the connection point, and I think that just updating the wording, and if you're fine with that, then we can make sure we're talking about the same thing. So I think we're good.
Yep.
All right. So then the next one that had been called out was in the priority target area of interoperability. And here, the had a variety of comments, but one of them was collaborate with industry to establish standardized definitions of three of these data elements so payers can write their rules knowing the payers and providers can write the rules knowing the precise definition and format of the data to enable the API standards for prior authorization and to be moved forward. So there was a number of recommendations that focused on convergence of standards and code sets, but I don't know if we actually, either 6 or 9, got down to the level of definitions of terminology, because where there was expressed some concern was the fact that today providers have many payers they have to interface with who all have different terms and they're all defined differently. So although we may not be able to have all the exact same rules, certainly any terms that are common to the industry should be defined in a consistent way so that there can be an API or a programmatic interface that can be based on that standard terminology. So I think we just wanted to make sure in the recommendation, how could we modify that slightly in either 6 or 9 to also include the definitions of common terminology that's not currently, I guess that's not 9 because that's attachment standard. So it's like 5 and 6 where.
Yeah. If I'm reading you right or hearing you right, so 6 is about making the standards available to implement. What we want is an additional recommendation that says we need to focus on standardizing the terminology for administrative workflows to make sure that all actors are using common terms.
So, all right, you would see that as a new recommendation?
I'd see that as a new recommendation, maybe new recommendation detail as part of one of the existing recommendations. I think it's a great point and definitely needs to be added.
All right, so harmonize. Definitions. You do have a very good way of saying things, administrative terminology. Okay. I'm going to put in a holding point so I can come back to that. All right. And good. So that was another one of the gaps that Deb and I had identified. And then let me see. I need to go down to this one. All right, so we had one that was related to establishing, and Deb, I have to apologize because I'm not sure I understood this one, but we're not going to flash it up there, but it was establish a lightweight and feasible exception process to achieve the spirit of 162.940. And I have to apologize because I don't know exactly what 162.940 is referring to, but it says the exception process for national standards is burdensome for innovation and requires a level of orchestration that leads to a non-starter. History shows this by the lack of requests. NCPDP asked in the rule to permit a script example. So the gap that was captured was, might this cause a high level of experimentation in the industry, thus increasing burden on partners? So I put it for a discussion item because one of the comments was partners would be willing participants in some sort of pilots or only well-vetted options should be considered based on X amount of interval and external successful testing with partners. So a personal interview by the ISA team so they can vet the success. So really, to me, it sounds like vetting the success of exceptions and how the exception process should work with the ISA. And
well,
I'm not
right.
familiar
so,
with that
so
process.
So what it was initially targeting is that there is a process for people to go ahead and pilot new things, but a lot of people have not submitted a request to do that and to start to partake in any of these pilots to try new transactions, new things with partners and so forth. So while there is a way to do that, it is highly unused. And, you know, there, and I think part of it is because a lot of people didn't necessarily know, they weren't aware that it was necessarily there and they could do that. And two, I think people didn't understand, or the process was too cumbersome for people to sort of say, hey, you know, I've been working with these two payers or payers and vendors or clearinghouses, and I've got a great thing that seems to be working for us. Let's put in for a pilot and try to get this exercise so that we can create some criteria of success so that we can present it to the powers that be to see if people want to adopt this new thing.
Okay.
So to that point, I think we may want to scroll up to recommendation two, because I think what's happening here is that some people may recall that Deb volunteered to take on looking at the gaps that we may have between some of our discussions and of over the last couple of months. There's been some side work back and forth between Deb Strickland and Cheryl Turney, and what they're doing is they're bringing the results of that synthesis effort forward, and they've identified a challenge with what I believe to be recommendation two.
Okay, so yeah, so we would need to add an additional point. That's great, Alex. I didn't know where to put it, so I'll make a note in here that we need to add an exception to the exception standards.
It was trying to link actually sort of the HIPAA world meets the tremendous new flexibility that ONC has promulgated.
Okay, and this
for SVAMP
relates to the gap identified within ISA. Okay, that's perfect, because I wasn't sure where this one belonged, and you guys were right on the spot. So, all right, let me go to the next one. The next one's really talking about promoting and implementing a national piloting process, which we don't specifically call out in our recommendations. So I don't know if we need to add a recommendation regarding that, or if we left it off because of there are a lot of complexities with pilots. You know, within HL7, there's a formal pilot process.
If I could jump in here for a second, I want to be careful to distinguish between testing that's done at HL7 in the form of a connectathon from the concepts of true piloting to get like measurement and qualitative and quantitative feedback on the viability of an actual standard in a more representative environment.
I agree with both of those. Yeah, I agree with both of those comments and think we should add them both to recommendation number two.
Well, I would like to actually talk about this a little bit, Aaron, because I think it makes a lot of sense, but I'm wondering if we might be diluting our message if we try to put this all into one bucket, because this concept of the standards version advancement process is new. But this issue of will we test it in a robust manner to support us in being able to make wise adoption choices is a separate issue.
I'm good on that. So I agree with the point and good with adding a separate recommendation for both testing and piloting.
Okay.
I think those could go together to some degree, yes.
Yep.
Go ahead.
We would want to add a testing and piloting recommendation, and I'm thinking that should go further down in the here, like maybe after recommendation six, unless you have a better place you want to put it.
After you get Arian's response to that, I will note that Jocelyn has raised her hand.
Aaron, would you be able to
I'll just take the point and do an editing pass. So.
Okay. All right. So
for doing that. So we want to add a placeholder for Aaron to do his editing pass to add testing and piloting, which I believe we've always intended to include on our list.
All right. Yes. and I am adding that note right now. Okay. All right, we can go ahead to the next question.
Jocelyn has her hand raised. Ms. Keegan?
Thanks, Alex. So I completely wholeheartedly agree with the idea that testing and piloting needs to be its own separate issue. I think for me, I think one of the things, and Jim and Josh and I talked about this while we were doing the sort of the standard landscape portion of the document, is right now the current ability for someone to innovate through our existing exception process is incredibly burdensome. So I think whatever we say about piloting and measurement for success is that there needs to be a way to reduce that heavy lift that we currently place, both from creating sort of the architecture, the agreements to get to an exception, and the burden and the cost of actually being able to pilot something at scale. So I don't know, Arianne, if you can channel sort of my inner point here to really talk about not just that we need to pilot and test, but we need to do it in a place where you don't have to be, you know, one of the five big guys to actually have the resources and the time and the money to be able to experiment.
Got it.
Yeah, and I would like to say on that too that having been personally involved in a number of opportunities to do pilots, you know, quite honestly, as a payer, we're still working on an agreement with some of the providers who, you know, we wanted to do pilots with. Others went very quickly, and some of the larger ones take forever. So it really inhibits your ability to do the pilot when you can't agree on the, you know, terms of, you know, how you're going to share the data. Maybe that's outside of this, but if there was a simpler structure that we could all be working on to do these pilots where we all agree to the same, you know, terms and operations to do so would be wonderful.
So Cheryl, let me ask you a question about that. Are you talking about like having standardized synthetic data that we use? Is that what you?
Well,
like an actual test
technique.
Environment stood up? Okay.
That's a technique, but since we don't have that today, just getting a data use agreement in place so we can do the pilot is challenging with some of our provider partners.
Because it's,
you know,
not a compliant transaction. Okay.
Yeah, it's a chicken egg problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be burdensome because then you're talking about, you know, hundreds of hours with a lawyer that costs a lot of money, and, you know, essentially just to try to get, you know, what's the issue. So to me, some of these things would be helpful if there was a, you know, we're not going to use the data for any other purpose and blah, blah, blah. We all agree to that, which is all the things that normal people would want. Then you can have a utility sort of set up and all agree to operate the same way. But in absence of that, that does get in the way of your ability to do the pilot and actually get the benefit.
Yeah, and on the standard side, like on the X12 side and stuff, for years we have had the issue where there is no hard and fast requirements on what the pilot must cover. It was kind of just thrown out there that it had to be piloted and had to be successful, but there's no success criteria. You know, how and who judges what the success is of a pilot? And, you know, also there was always the issue of willing trading partners to build out environments at their expense, right? There's
right.
not a lot of motivation to build an end-to-end system that mimics production.
Yeah, so if there was some sort of utility network that was already set up for this, to me, that would benefit all of us. You know, it would be like, you know, you have to adhere to these common agreements in order to participate, and then you plug in and you go, rather than, you know, have these protracted obstacles that, you know, create burden for everyone and really don't have much value to them. I mean, if I wanted to pilot with five different provider groups that have to have five sets of negotiations for a data use agreement. You know, to me, maybe some of the things are to set up a template that says, you know, for all the things we're piloting, these are the things that we would expect partners to adhere to, and everybody agrees, hopefully. I don't know, maybe that's too much policy. All right, let's move on to the next one. Okay, so there was another one. So here, this one was, again, focused on the automation and the workflow, speaking about that today there's no consistency across all the payers as to what all the required data is. And we need to develop a consistent template so that for each type of condition or whatever needs to get approval, there is consistent data collected. Now, again, I do believe that recommendations do speak to this relative to the workflow. I just don't know if they go specific enough to, you know, capture all the thoughts. So, I want to go back to the workflow one, which was recommendation 7. And I just have to read this again. Right, so this, would this language here be strong enough or detailed enough to include the concept that we had discussed that basically requires that the list of procedures that require prior authorization be communicated, and for that list of procedures or services, all the data requirements are defined and defined in a common way.
So I completely agree with the concept. I forget if I wrote that up or not. I thought I did, and maybe let me just take a little bit of offline work and see if I can figure out where it lives right now.
So I think this, if I remember correctly, back when I did this, I think it was sort of on the premise, and remember the old the example of the wheelchair and how much the person weighs, and in collecting all of the data that is necessary in order to do the job effectively the first time.
Yep. You're right on, Deb.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree on the point, and just want to make sure that it's not already captured in language, and if it's not, then we certainly need to add it.
Yeah, so I think it belongs in 7. That's what I
think it's 11.
Oh, 11.
Because 7's about patient engagement, and 11 is about standards for prior authorization.
Okay.
Which is good if you want to take a look at 11, because one of the things that we identified during last week's discussion, Erin, which I know you were unable to attend, we identified that there were multiple recommendations and we're trying to be extremely discreet.
Yep.
So if you look there, you might have not only ability to bolster one item, but also break it into two recommendations.
Yep, got it.
Yeah. And this is
not
exactly, you know, yeah.
Yeah, so it sounds like for 11, what we want to do is be more clear about the intent of 11 is additionally to include documentation of what's required and what services require prior authorization and what steps are required in the prior authorization process. And number 2 is we want to break any of these bulky recommendations down into recommendation-lets so that they establish severability.
Okay, I like that idea also. Okay. I like both of those.
So whoever's got the master and is putting notes in, if you can give me those annotations and flip it back, and I'll do the editing turn.
I think we'll go with Michael, because that's what he's adding.
Cool.
Some notes Alan, I don't want, I added notes as well, but, you know, Michael, I'll go back and add my notes to yours if we need to expand them, but.
Okay, well, I'm working in the document you sent, not in the live Google Doc, but I can move them over later on.
Yeah, that sounds good. All right, so this is exactly what we wanted this gap document to do, and so far we're finding some good things. So we have another one, which was that it referred back to the workflow. So,
I'm sorry, Cheryl. I'm sorry for interrupting. I just want to clarify that, Michael, I think you've gotten half of the request for the nudge. Do you want Arian to give you a little bit of a reprise on the other concept he wants a footnote on or comment on?
Sure.
Yeah, so I think the two things were, number one, making sure that we're breaking up 11. And number two is, so you got that one. Number two is ensure that we have specific recommendations for making the list of procedures or other orderables, procedures or orderables that require prior authorization available. And B, make sure that the requirements for the prior authorization are available for each of those procedures or orderables.
And that would be the content of what specifics are necessary, height of the person, weight of the person.
Exactly.
That type of thing, electric versus manual, and just referencing the, chair.
By way of example, for a wheelchair, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yep, got it.
Okay, that sounds good. All right, let me know when you're ready, Michael.
Okay.
All right, so that was pretty much it for the there was a lot of other things identified in the gap document, but all of them really were addressed with recommendations that we already had discussed last week. But we did another little piece of work, and that was that Andrew, one of the supporting individuals from the ONC, developed a compendium with the recommendations from all of the third-party vendors and agencies and representatives, stakeholders that came to do presentations for us. And out of those, we also did a comparison between what they recommended and our recommendations. So I made a few notes based on those as well. And I don't know whether it makes sense for us to review those in total, Michael, because this is not information that we've really shared at all with the group.
Sure.
So,
you see the document up?
Yeah. Not yet. It's blue.
Oh, yeah, okay. It's
okay.
So for people to understand, is he's navigating on his different applications. Sometimes it that's what grays it out.
Now we see it. Of course, it's
you see
not
it now?
Blue screen. Yes, we do.
Okay, great.
So thank you so much. So essentially, I'll walk us through this document so people will understand. So what they did was go through and pull out of the decks and the letters we got, emails, from each of these groups, you know, what their recommendations were. And what I did was actually make notes relative to the ones that appeared to maybe either go beyond what we had recommended or had different recommendations than what we had recommended, or I wasn't clear on the recommendations, so that we could discuss those, because at the end of the day, we want to be able to say, you know, this is what we did, this is how we did it, this is all the information we considered, and after all of this, these are the list of recommendations that we had. So essentially, the first thing up was Cover My Meds, and they had a number of ideas in terms of the ideal state and workflow, and then they have made some steps to get to the ideal state. And one was better eligibility and benefits data, you know, shared real time, like the real time benefit check that's being utilized by some providers, but not all of them yet. And so they were looking to expand that to a wider and broader audience. But also, one of the questions I had here was the automated processes, like when I read this, the DRLS process and the real-time benefit check sort of need to adopt standards so that EMR systems are able to consistently present the administrative data for the verification of benefits at a granular level, so they're required to provide accurate data in the file. So really what I was thinking about there is that, again, some EMRs have adopted this. There are some pilots that are going on, but there's actually no rule that says you have to use this. So as part of our process, maybe we want to recommend that there is more administrative capability to include this real-time benefit check and the real-time benefit transparency so that the EMR systems, you know, are required to have it for certification purposes and the ability to execute on those in a real-time benefit way it consistently, you know, for all, you know, all their interchanges. And then the administrative systems need to be able to provide the data as they, you know, currently do through the standard required to satisfy from, you know, HIPAA with the X12 transactions. So, you know, I don't know if there's more that we would need to add to our recommendations. We definitely talk about standardizing and harmonizing code sets and standards, but I don't know if we go as far as saying that we want to, you know, encourage adoption of, you know, these types of electronic processes. What does the team think?
So Cheryl, are you asking us if we think that we should have some sort of a recommendation about more real-time general, like transaction processing generally,
right,
as a concept?
Yeah, because a lot of these recommendations from all these partners really cover the theme of, you know, requiring a real-time response for things like benefit check and, you know, the status of someone's deductible, all of that stuff.
Thank you for clarifying that. I thought that's what you were looking for. And we have our first hand raised in Jocelyn, followed by Arian.
Perfect.
Okay, so I think that this concept of getting to real time is incredibly important. I think that I would pair anytime we're talking about real time with workflow, because I think where it gets serviced and how the data is made available ahead of the actual transaction happening is really at the heart of what we're trying to improve here. It's not just about automating an existing PA. It's about getting better data in place so you could potentially avoid a PA. You could get more information about that patient-specific benefit so that you could do the thing that they're, that me as a, you know, individual who has health insurance is covered by the plan I pay for, and reduce waste for everybody that's involved if it makes sense. And then if and when I need to do more, then making that as automated as possible for the right person in the practice that needs to do that work and keeping it visible for me as a patient so that I'm not wasting time going to the pharmacy when I'm pended for PA, right? So I think that to me, it's a holistic ideal that is more than just automating the actual step. And I think this point down here around, you know, we got to see, you know, CNM does a great job of masking that for the end user and gapping, right, where there aren't standards to do that. the only other point I would make here is I think that we have two worlds when it comes to PA. You know, we see really great penetration with NCPDP and the prior auth workflows and the work to improve the real-time benefit check in workflow for providers through the EHRs, and all the EHRs talk NCPDP today in their e-prescribing app. I don't think we want to necessarily break that. I think we want to augment that. And we want to get the other half of the world, which is order entry, either inside a facility or outside of a facility that requires prior authorization or other predecessor steps to somebody actually getting what was ordered, diagnosed, what therapy they're being put on, is automated as we've achieved over on the pharmacy side. And that was a little bit of a soliloquy. I apologize, but I feel like I don't want to make sort of the search for real time masking sort of these underlying earlier steps that could help reduce or remove or throw the baby out with the bathwater because, you know, we're just on the search for automation.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is the accurate thing, Jocelyn, because, you know, I will just share this one example where recently there's been noted like a lot of false positives with COVID. And it doesn't really apply to the prior authorization model, but it does apply to the intersection of clinical administrative data. And a few, it was an off-work situation where a number of people were saying, I got calls about being positive when I'm not positive, and they weren't understanding what that means. And so, you know, if there was the ability for not only the administrative system to get the test results of a lab work like that, in addition to the provider, then prevention of those types of things could occur, because what may be happening in some scenarios, certainly not all, but some, this person called the doctor and said, I don't know why I'm getting called because this was negative. And they said, oh, well, we get reimbursed more for a positive test. And that's what they were told on the phone. And that happened to more than one person. But in that scenario, the whole thing can be avoided if payers, as well as providers, get the test results for the COVID, because then it's a self-auditing type of system. And that's another reason why the intersection of clinical and administrative data is so important, because it's going to prevent those types of situations from occurring. And I know I sort of changed what you were saying, Jocelyn, but I do think that an important point isn't real time. It's having the data where you need it when decisions and actions are made on it. That's important. And it needs to be in some timely way, but it certainly doesn't need to be real time. But I don't know if our recommendations go far enough to save that.
Right. So, Jocelyn, are you saying that there should be sort of a way for us to have a pre-conversation about what's needed in order to create a good, solid PA? So, like, you know, if you say, I need a wheelchair, and then they say, okay, these are the things that I'm going to need from you in order for us to get this order right, you know, size of the person, weight of the person, height, automated, you know, manual wheelchair or electric wheelchair, that kind of stuff, and make sure that they come back and tell us everything we're going to need so that when we send in the PA, it's everything. And most likely to get approved. Is that what you're saying, to try to have some, if we do real time, to kind of put it as a conversational step in the beginning?
And it's funny. So I wouldn't say that we don't want to do real time. I think that, you know, we're working towards API, so we want things to be as automated as real time as possible. I just don't want to overemphasize real time and forget about the predecessor steps that you're discussing, Alexis, which is really the transparency piece and the understanding what somebody's actual benefits are and where they are in a plan year and what they've experienced, succeeded and failed in the past is all part of their clinical record that either the provider or the payer has, and making that data, freeing that data to be looked at and reviewed and made digital if and when you need to do the prior auth, that, you know, there's a, we of course want to automate. We of course want things to be real time. I just think that it's not the penultimate goal. There are also things we could be doing to completely avoid and reduce the number of prior authorizations that we're submitting.
Yeah.
And so to your point, Alexis, if I knew exactly what the criteria is and I knew that I was going to meet the criteria.
I'm just going to interrupt you because I don't know who was speaking, but it wasn't Alexis.
Oh, it wasn't Alexis.
To find out who it was. It was. That's why I don't want to say who they are and maybe
Deb.
Raise their hand.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry, Deb.
No, okay.
I think that at the heart of what my point is not that anything we're saying here about real time is a negative. I think it's where we want to head. I just think that there are predecessor steps to creating a transparency and understanding what the rules are and the coverage details are, whether it's on the pharmacy side or the medical side, so that the provider and the patient can actually understand that before they move forward. So we can just reduce the total number of prior authorization requests.
Yeah.
And to your point, that the rules are clear, so when somebody goes to submit, they submit clean, and it doesn't become this, you know, four-week-long exercise to make sure there's five different handoffs back and forth to get all the data in place, right? You actually know what you need to submit to meet criteria.
Yeah.
So I think that if we're getting this captured, hopefully, and so let's just keep folks oriented that what we're looking at is fodder from the presentations we've received, and Cheryl feels there's some areas we may need to tease out for modifying or adding to our existing recommendations. So what I'm hearing is that we need to clearly look at when we're talking about the workflows and automation, we also want to be making sure we have we've clearly thought about and made a choice on to what degree we think real time is important as a recommendation in and of itself. But these are components of the overall recommendations flow, if I'm hearing this whole conversation correctly. Cheryl, you can validate or redirect me there.
Yes. 100%.
Okay. 100%. Okay. So you now have Arian, Jim, and Anil in the queue.
All right. Go ahead, Arian.
All right, so I've got two hats on. One is a task force member hat on. The other is a editor hat on, and I'm trying to keep those two things separate. So, with my task force member hat on, I think we've, and I don't think this is in the document, but I think we've talked about the need for eligibility checks to have more precision and data available to them to drive more downstream workflows. So I want to put that out there as a possible recommendation. Number two is I think there was a possible recommendation for industry to adopt and potentially to certify against the real-time benefit check standard. And I want to make sure that we either contemplate or, you know, contemplate not that that's a recommendation. The notion that, so now with my editor hat on, the notion that that we should be designing standards so that they can be automatable in workflow is definitely recommendation fodder and was already agreed on by the task force and hopefully is in the recommendations as drafted, and if they're not, it's an editing error and needs to be added to that. So maybe I'm trying to distinguish between three different things. One is the need for more data and eligibility checks to distinguish downstream, to better inform downstream information. Number two is whether the real-time benefit check standard, the NCPDP standard for benefit discovery and electronic prior auth in the pharmacy workflow needs to be added as a recommendation. And number three is I believe that there are adequate recommendation intent, at least, even if it's not fully captured in the text, to drive automation in workflow. And I'm more than happy to take another pass and make sure that the wording there is super clear. And if there's areas where people don't feel like it's captured, feel free to point it out to me, and I'm happy to make sure that that gets edited back in.
Right. So I think that to that point, if I may just chime in, Rich did indicate that you had not 100% completed all the recommendation integration work. So this is a good check for us too. And I think Michael, he's looking for not only the drive for automation and workflow, but also the aspect related to eligibility was the other piece that he said during his summary there that he probably wants a footnote on.
And one of the things I just wanted to add, Arian, to what you were saying about the intersection in the exchange of data, I think a lot of the comments that were made throughout the third-party stakeholders were things like, you know, if a patient goes to a lab that's attached to our hospital, then that data is visible in the EMR, but if they don't, then it isn't. And so having consistent process to get that same lab data within the EMR system of the physician that needs it, I think is also a component of this. So that's the only reason why I kind of called it out as well, because I think that came out in that, you know, cover my meds discussion. So, all right, we can move on to Anil.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm not sure if this is even a relevant comment anymore because we've talked a lot about the real time and then automation, but I've heard some comments. I just want to make sure that from a clinician point of view, we only want the patient to really think about that he or she knows where the clinical decisions are being made. And I think some of the conversation, it sounded like you could have multiple copies of, for example, test results sent to the provider and the payer so that the patient could seek opinions from both. I think that's very dangerous. I think we don't want to use the intersection of clinical and administrative data and the work that needs to be put in there to further maybe confuse the patient as to how those clinical decisions are being made. I'm all for automation of administrative workflows and getting information earlier that would be relevant for a prior auth. But when you start to talk about care, I hope we can all agree that that should still be the purview of the clinician provider, if you will, and say a payer who may not have a full clinical history, may just have bits of data. And I maybe I misheard, but I think it's really important that we focus whatever we do about bringing these two disparate universes together, that we don't want to mess up the relationship that a patient has with their providers.
I think we would all agree with that, Anil.
Okay.
I noticed that Jim had – thank you, Anil. I noticed that Jim had his hand up. He took it down, but now he's writing in the chat box. So I'm not sure if he still wanted to chat.
Oh, hey there. Yeah, thank you.
Jim.
I was going to bumper Jocelyn's comment about defining real time a bit because her last comment about making sure that there was enough time for completeness of data before a decision is rendered. One of the unintended consequences of automation in real time we experienced in a real world pilot was, you know, automation from the EMR to the payer of data, premature denials that then led to appeals that occurred only because not enough time had occurred for additional information to come in. So I think this real time, you know, when it comes to automating, extracting data to then lead to a decision, needs to be tempered so that unintended consequences don't occur. There's a timing and a completeness factor that needs to be spoken to.
Mm,
yeah.
That goes along with the name.
Important consideration.
Yeah, I like Jocelyn just wrote, not real time, but at the right time with the right information. It's really the R4. The right patient, the right time, the right provider, the right information. And Jocelyn is up in the queue next, Cheryl. And Alexis.
All right, go ahead.
I think my hand just didn't get unraised. I'm all set.
Alexis?
I was just confused about what Anil was, the point he was trying to get across about not confusing patients with too much information.
And no.
Jeopardizing the relationship between the clinician and the patient because they have too much information.
No, that's not what I meant. I'm sorry, Alexis. What I'm saying is I think it was the example of the COVID test results where I think Cheryl mentioned that if the payer also got the results along with the provider, then the payer could help the patient understand. And what I can think of, maybe
that's why I said that's not what I meant. I meant if the payer got the results, then they would know that that they were negative, and so a provider's not going to be able to put that in as a positive test, because in this case, there appears to be some providers that are over-reporting because of reimbursement, and it has nothing to do with any engagement with the patient. But the patient in this case called the payer to see if they knew, and they didn't know. It wasn't me suggesting that they know.
Yeah, so
the payer should not know.
If they are paying more for a patient that, you know, basically we're told they're tested positive, until we do an audit, we wouldn't know in one way or the other. And again,
you shouldn't unless it somehow comes up as a red flag for an audit, because you shouldn't have information about diagnosis.
Okay, so
certainly if a patient does bring it to the payer's attention to say, hey, this is a mistake, and did you know about this because they're billing you more than they should, then that's different. But I still don't. So, Anil, do you just take back anything rather than trying to explain what you meant, because you were explaining something that was different than what she was talking about?
Yeah, let me make sure that I don't confuse us further.
What
I'm getting at, number one, we don't want to disrupt the physician-patient relationship. I think we can all agree on that. Number two, physicians may have more information about why certain results of tests, I'm just using that as an example, when in combination with other information, may not tell the same story. In the example that Cheryl's bringing up, there are patients who will have a negative COVID test, but will have a CT scan that clearly shows and consistent with COVID, and therefore the doctor may diagnose the patient with COVID. Patients may understand that, they may not, I don't know, depends on the relationship and the communication style. But if all the payer had was a negative test result, they could make the wrong conclusion. So what I'm trying to say is, of course, more information for the patient is good. But if the payer had information that was in a vacuum of the provider-patient relationship, then we could have unintended consequences. And what we don't want to do in the work of bringing the administrative and clinical data together is inadvertently create, and I think Jim said this already, the unintended consequences of perhaps the wrong information at the wrong time in the wrong context. And I'm not saying that physicians are flawless, and there may be physicians who are gaming the system, but the vast majority of them, I'm sure, are trying to do the right thing, and they may have more information than snippets of data that a payer might get. That's what I was trying to say.
Do you mind if I piggyback on that?
Of course.
Examples where there's gray area, right, where it really sometimes the logic for the rule set the payer's using is pretty crisp and well-defined, but in many instances there's gray area. Or suspicion of tuberculosis leads to needing therapy for it, but there is no tuberculosis test back yet. Those are examples, I think, of what you're talking about, right, where we could get so ahead of ourselves that we have inappropriate denials because we think the EMR has all the data needed to make a definitive authorization decision. Is that the kind of topic you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think it gets even more murky when if you go beyond just the automation required for the transaction, like in the case of PA, but you start to think about a world where the payer would somehow also have all that data in advance, but doesn't have the same relationship. They have a relationship, but the same relationship with the patient. The patient may be confused as to who is making the clinical decision, and that's not a place where we want to take the way medicine organized right now.
I think those are really important points to note as well. You know, at the end of the day, we don't want our recommendations to
disturb the patient-provider relationship. We want them to support that so it's a stronger relationship. So I think this goes along with the goal and the ideal state where we don't want to create more burden and we don't want to create more confusion. So, you know, I think that those are all really valid points. Okay, so there are a few more things to discuss from the recommendations. So you want to go down. Let's see. The next one that I thought we should talk about is, I think, on the third or fourth page. Premier, which is at the bottom of the third page, Michael, they recommended there should be incentives for using health IT that reduce burden and provide value to clinicians. I don't think we put anything in our recommendations related to incentives.
I believe that's there. It just is couched in a way that people may not understand it. So all the language around aligning CMS programs and certification criteria is intended to provide the regulatory avenue for incentives. And again, this may just be, I may be too deep in the regulatory weeds to understand how people who aren't that deep read all that.
Yeah. And that's what I was thinking also. So that's why I just asked the question, because I wasn't sure. I know, you know, these systems like the one Premier created and the one that Epic has for the payer portal are quite expensive. And I don't know who the incentives for utilizing those would be intended to go to, but both providers and payers would be paying for them. So it's an expensive proposition for both sides. And really, it appears that, you know, the smaller providers would be the ones that may not have the opportunity to utilize those without some substantial incentives because of their cost. All right, then if we move down to the end of page four, there was a couple questions here. EHRA made recommendations, and I don't know if these got addressed. They wanted to establish an authorization at a higher level than a procedure, a service, a test, or a DME. So they wanted to shift from fee-for-service to value-based. I can say as a payer, in many of our value-based arrangements, we, and I know other payers, eliminate the need for a number of prior authorizations. Not all of them, but certainly the most common ones where there's sufficient data and the providers have risk related. I know we did many pilots on this, and a number of these are being expanded, but I don't know what the lever is that they're looking for to include for value-based payments, but that was their suggestion. And then they indicated if there were opportunities where we can effectively have no need for authorizations, what can be done so that, you know, they're not needed. So I don't know if there might be more piloting that could be recommended for the value-based care arrangements. I know, you know, for us, that was a very beneficial exercise, and, you know, now we're basically taking it much broader. But again, I don't know exactly what they were looking to establish other than some sort of incentive to implement reduction of prior authorizations in value-based arrangements. And I don't know if we really spoke to the
right.
Okay, right, go ahead.
Sarah, I thought you were
I think this is an area that we talked about as a group and agreed on, and I may not have made it into the recommendation text, but definitely needs to. So the conversation we had as a group was that to the extent possible, PA should be eliminated in cases where incentives are appropriately aligned. So if I'm approved for a bundle, then that should, you know, you don't need to micromanage my decisions because I'm already approved for the bundle and already reimbursed for the bundle. So I think we can make additional recommendation text for relative to including incentives in value-based programs that reduce the need for prior authorization.
Yeah, that's it exactly.
Cheryl, I've raised my hand to follow on to Arian's point here, because I don't think it's necessarily a piloting aspect, but I do think it's this policy framework, and maybe there's somewhere tied into either probably not as a part of our transparency per se on the medical policy, but more of a secondary related recommendation that might speak to, in value-based care, there should already be the ability to, for a disease state, enable that provider to make the determinations about what services are needed without a prior auth. I think that's sort of what we're getting at.
Yeah. Okay, I think we just need to say something more explicitly than in the recommendations than what we've said regarding that. So
clearly, I think there's sentiments along those lines, and hopefully if anyone's disagreeing with that philosophy, they'd speak up and let us know. Otherwise, we could be going down a rabbit hole on writing that we shouldn't be.
Yeah, so raise your hand if you have a comment.
And Neil has raised his hand.
Yeah, and I think this may just be a subtlety, but I think what we're really saying is that anytime the physician or the clinician is taking on the risk, there really is no other further incentive to have prior auth. It's not just
why do you need one?
Yeah.
What's that?
Yes.
Yeah. But the
it's like, why would you even need a PA?
Mm-hmm. Well, the incentive is to expand the value-based arrangement, so there'd be fewer and fewer PAs. That's the incentive. It's to expand
value. Yeah. I do want to make a comment that if it's what we're advocating, that we don't need PAs in the setting where the doc is taking the risk in a value-based arrangement, then what is the purpose of the PA is simply to reduce unnecessary expense when they're in a fee-for-service arrangement. And so I think this could have a...
Let me ask you a question there, because I remember some earlier discussion. I think actually Gus might have made a comment or two in the past about being in an awkward situation where you want to not undermine the trust relationship between the patient and the doctor, but the doctor may be actually prescribing an outdated treatment, and that there was actually sort of a nice safety valve on behalf of the patient to have somebody else that looking at it and considering it from evidence-based medicine perspective. And I noticed that as I was chatting, I've seen Gus's hand go up and then Alexis, so I will defer. Gus?
Yes. Go ahead and let you finish your thought.
Yeah, I was just going to say that the only way that I think the one way to make this language comfortable is to say that it then needs to be coupled with strong clinical decision support that the providers then take on, because we're all saying that we want less PA, but we don't want is because the risk is now shifted to the clinicians that wrong things still happen. I mean, it's mm-hmm. not good for the patient. At the end of the day, we're supposed to be making this patient centric. And so I think we need to say that in the event where the clinician is taking on risk in a value-based arrangement and is utilizing, you know, clinical decision support tools that provide them guidelines, that the PA is unnecessary.
So
the PA from the payer.
I'll jump in there and say that the trouble with that is that if you've seen one value-based program, you've seen one value-based program, and they're all so very different in terms of what is being incented and how it's being incented. And to say that if you're in a value-based arrangement, you don't need PA is kind of leaping to an ideal space, but not a realistic one, because the providers that go into a value-based arrangement that may be entirely appropriate, but it may still require PA in the sense that it's not just about the dollars. I love telling somebody they can't have a CAT scan because an MRI is more appropriate. So So, I mean, you know, requesting a CAT scan and then discovering later that it was the wrong test and you should have done an MRI is as much of a waste of money as, you know, ordering an MRI when a CAT scan will do. So I would be cautious about, you know, a broad statement like that, given the various natures of value-based arrangements. I do think that, you know, and as Alex pointed out, I've made this point before, sometimes the insurer is put in the position of saying, you know, that is the wrong test, that is the wrong treatment. You know, I know you trained 20 years ago, but, you know, update your data, your information. And that happens, I mean, that accounts for a large number of the prior auths that are denied. Is just docs not staying up to date as they should be. So I'll shut up there.
You have Alexis and Jim in the queue, Cheryl.
All right, go ahead,
yeah,
Alexis.
I mean, I was just basically going to agree with, I mean, I'll just agree now with what Jim was saying. I mean, I was going to call attention to what Alex brought up, that we did have conversation that, you know, quite often the payer ends up being the safety net. I mean, honestly, as an aside, I don't think that that's what it's about. I think it's about trying, it's a loophole safety net because it's about cost in the end, usually is. But there is this value piece that they do catch errors. And it's kind of what I was getting at with what I was asking Anil before. And without the patient being able to have full transparency to that decision process and what went into the guidelines behind the PA decision, you can intervene and correct things. And I actually recently had that happen. It wasn't the safety issue. However, I got, you know, the PA denial information by mail that was fully transparent about the process it went through, surprisingly. Kudos to Cigna for a good job this time, and they were able to give me fully transparent information when I called. I just wish that I didn't have to call and was able to look it up easily online. But it went through a process with a completely inaccurate patient diagnosis and why the medication was being requested. And so without me being able to see that and again, unfortunately, having to be the go-between to correct it, I was getting different information from the provider than from the payer. And now was able to go back to the provider and say, no, that's not why it was denied. This is why it's denied. And it's because you didn't provide X, Y, and Z, and whoever filled out the prior authorization in your office put down the wrong diagnosis. So there's that piece too, beyond the safety piece. You know, back to Anil's point in the beginning, that I can understand the concerns over protecting relationship and it being the clinical decision and not being second guessed, but sometimes, unfortunately, it's helpful.
Yeah, good, very good points, Alexis. Thank you for sharing that. We have Jim now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hey, thank you. I think that your point, Anil, is good that, why do you need a PA? Well, you know, when we did some Medicare Advantage work, you know, and the risk did shift to the practice, it didn't change. I mean, the practice now wanted there to be a PA, right? Because they were on the hook. So to me, the PA may not have to come from the insurer or payer because now they're not on the hook, but that infrastructure may be still helpful and useful to the practice. You know, because for my perch, you know, some of bad decisions by docs, let's just say the instances where docs do the MRI and shouldn't, some of it's driven by just not being informed, but other times it's driven by the microeconomics of the doctor in a busy practice. It takes a lot more time to explain to the patient why. It's not always unhelpful to have a third party actually, you know, hey, they're not going to approve it because we really need to do physical therapy first. It's not unhelpful. So you're right. It may not be that there's an incentive for the payer to do the prior auth, but if risk is shifted to me, I'd still want there to be a process in place so that inappropriate tests aren't ordered. and the payers may already have infrastructure in place that accomplishes that, or you know, combined with the practice efforts, can control. For example, you know, in Medicare Advantage, you know, reducing the number of inappropriate referrals to specialists is a major piece that the practices go after themselves instead of the insurance company. So that's an example of a prior auth, if you would. So still very
that's
useful.
Thanks, Jim. That's very good. All right, if we don't have any more questions on this point, I think we've got a lot of information we can use in the update process. There's one more point, and again, I know we call out workflows, and we do have a recommendation around the workflows, but you know, one of the comments, and this came from multiple sources, not just the group that brought it forward in a formal recommendation from EHRA, but I received this in a separate group with the small providers from Connecticut, was that, you know, there are many payers that push providers to utilize portals. Some are, you know, multi-payer portals and some are not. But, you know, is there some process by which we can have the data integrated within the EMR so that it reduces the number of these outside portals that physicians need to utilize? Again, we did talk about the workflow and the automation, but maybe we need just to beef up some of the wording around with the intent to try to reduce the number of interfaces and portals that physicians have to support the ability to integrate these within some payer portal within the EMR in a standard, consistent way, you know, using our FHIR transactions would be, you know, needs to be clear. And what do you guys think about that? And Arian, I'm pretty sure that this is what you meant by the wording that you had.
I think it's worthwhile saying that the intent is to reduce or eliminate the use of payer-specific portals.
Yeah, okay. So I think we can add that to that recommendation that really speaks to that one, that's one of the side benefits to it.
I recognize that we are now at the time of public comment, but I do want to come back to this because, in essence, there's also a very specific recommendation that may need to be made there, because real-time capacity or clinical conversation capacity may not be what's promulgated today. So maybe we can come back to that.
Okay. Go ahead, Alex.
I think it's over to Lauren.
Yeah, we'll ask the operator to open the line, please.
Thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 to remove your comment from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we poll for comments. There are no comments at this time.
Okay, thank you. Alex and Cheryl, I'll let you know if any other comments come in.
Thank you, Lauren. So, Alex, do you want to continue the conversation on the last point?
I think that might make sense to do that. Recognizing I wasn't clear if you had more in the document. I think you said that was the last point from the analysis of you reviewing the recommendation summary that Andrew completed. Okay. So I also noticed that Alexis said something in the chat box about universal platform for PA regardless of a payer, I think was something that she might want to speak to. But I also think that for this comment about there was a reference to DaVinci and there was a reference to portals, you know, and the objective of having integration with electronic health records so that the clinician at the point of care and their support team can be working in that one capacity or tool, would need to have a different kind of integration, because today the 278X12 transaction for prior authorization is not getting integrated, to my knowledge, all the way back into the EHR systems. And yet I think that EHRA was saying, hey, we want to get more to the integration level. And so I'm wondering if that means something along the lines of making a different kind of recommendation than we have today, and whether we as a body would want to consider something that says we might have a 278 promulgated today. We don't have an exception process, that 162.940 reference, that's proven out the ability for us to give the fodder to a national standards group to maybe make a different standard available to do the prior authorization function. Do we want to go to the point of talking about that in our recommendations?
Anyone from the group have any thoughts on it? I mean, I do think that this is something that we should talk about. I guess what I was envisioning, what Alexis said, was more in line of having, you know, essentially, you know, as I've said before, in my ideal state, there's some open source type of solution where there's a payer portal that can be integrated into any EMR system based on, you know, this API that we've yet to develop to, you know, exchange that data and make the data available. Again, is it going to be real time? I don't know. But it would be data that is then readily available for the EMR system to be able to utilize, because it would be predefined to a standard. You know, that's sort of what I had envisioned when we first talked about this, you know, a few months ago.
Cheryl, this is Alexis, and I think that that's correct. And I think we did talk about that, but I was just typing in the chat box too, in reference to what Alex was saying. I think that we actually talked about the complete opposite, and it's in the recommendations and in the ideal state that, and we went around in circles, I think, a lot over this language a couple of weeks ago in a conversation. And so I'm not quite sure where it's landing, you know, now, or if it needs to be revisited. But we talked the opposite about making sure that while we were creating standards, we weren't setting up a monopoly for, you know, one group over another. You know, I'm not familiar with all the, you know, the X12s and all those letters and numbers that get thrown out. But we talked a lot about, you know, one not benefiting over another. And so to your question, do we need to change that and think more about something that becomes a national standard regardless?
I think that you bring up a really good point, Alexis, which is we have been wordsmithing our wordsmithing. And so was today's effort was really to make sure that we had effectively woven a thread from our presentations through our recommendations work to make sure we weren't missing anything. And I think we all have the opportunity when we now will be have a chance to go look at the draft report, because we will be seeing the updated content from Arian and Rich, as well as the other feedback that we've captured today being placed into our master draft document. And you know, some of you've already been in there, like yourself, Alexis, and making some comments. I think I saw Gus was in there as well. So what I'm hoping is that folks will, with today's conversation, which we've covered, we've actually been checking off a lot of loose ends, and really want to do a shout out to Cheryl for her deep dive over the weekend to help us tie those threads up. So that what can happen now is that on the close of today's meeting, with Michael's assistance, we'll refresh, we'll update any applicable sections, and then we'll get some further updates from Arian and Rich. But along the way, you can all go out and review the draft report and start to make comments about whatever you're seeing in the document. But you can also be thinking about, are we finding the right balancing act to move the industry forward with a better approach to prior authorization through our recommendations, and have we gone far enough to actually create some notable change? For our next... Go ahead, Cheryl.
I just wanted to say that that's a very good point, Alan.
Thank you. The next week, I apologize, but I will not be here, nor will several of our your other teammates, as there is an NCVHS hearing on Wednesday and Thursday of next week, so we will not be able to participate in the task force call. And Cheryl and will be walking you through review of the report, and in two parts. One, making sure you're becoming more familiar with it. Two, to help with resolution of the comments. What we've instituted is a weekly sort of touch base of looking at the comments that are coming in with our, to support our ability to resolve anything that needs some team discussion. Some things will just be, please, I think we need to wordsmith it here, some comments and edits that we can incorporate pretty straightforward. But there will be other times where we might have to have some philosophical kicking of the tires. And so that approach we will be doing regularly until we're complete with the report. However, we will also want to start at some point, whether it's next week or the week after, the broader intersection of clinical administrative data discussion. One of the things that we will hope to do, I think it's either next week or the week following, is to socialize our presentation to the HITAC. That slide deck Cheryl's already started working on, and we want to make sure you're understanding what we're going to present on September 9th. So we'll be socializing that a bit, I believe. Cheryl, keep me straight, either next week or the week after.
That's correct. After you give me your comments, Alex, then I'll update it and we will review it with the group.
So we are striving to be able to do that as early as next week. So the game plan is everybody on the task force has access to the Google Doc. Please go out and review the report, start making comments and edits in it, and know that we will continue to make that request. We are coming to the point where we are going to be starting to build out the content to reflect the broader intersection discussion. So that will be a major part of our work over in September. Cheryl, would you like to add any further comments?
No, did a great job, Allison. I just want to thank everybody for their participation today. This is exactly the kind of input that we need. And next week, I think as we're stepping through the report and reviewing the comments, hopefully it'll become more familiar. And please, if anyone cannot access the Google Doc, please copy us and the ONC so we can get your access granted so that you will be able to provide your input.
I think that's a wrap for today, folks.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good day.
Have a good day.
Thank you.